Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Symposium of the Lotus Eaters. Today we're joined by Bo. Hello.
All right.
And we are going to talk about the Stoicism of Epictetus. Now, Stoicism is a very weird philosophy. Many people look up to it. It has some brilliant insights, I think. But there's a big question to be debated as to whether it can be a good system of philosophy. Personally, I think that many philosophers, individually speaking, have really good insights. But when they try to create a system out of those insights, usually those systems generate plenty of nonsense. Mm. And I'm not certain that Stoicism avoids that. Now, let's say from the very beginning, what is your opinion on Stoicism? What do you think about it in a general way, manner?
Sure. I've got quite mixed feelings about it. I actually agree with what you said there. Yeah. I think there's big chunks of it which are brilliant, really great, great axioms to live your life by in real term, in real time. And then there's other bits I profoundly disagree with.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think are entirely wrong-headed. And we can get into it. So, I mean, I did, I've read a lot of the Meditations, Marcus Aurelius, and a fair big chunks of Seneca. And we're doing Epictetus.
Epictetus.
Epictetus. Well, now you pronounce it. You tell me how you pronounce it.
Because I think it's Epictetus.
Epictetus.
Yes.
I probably stopped that's the Roman attempting version. That. Yes. But I've heard it pronounced
Greek,
a few different
Epictetus.
Ways. And you're Greek, so whatever you say is correct. But I will sort of stop attempting to pronounce it correctly. His writings, I read, it's quite short, isn't it? I read all of his writings for this. I'd say half of it maybe I thought was just really good and interesting and correct. But a good half of it, maybe not quite half of it, I very, very much disagreed with. I don't know where he's got some of these ideas from. But Stoicism in general, I think quite often for the small stuff in life, it works. It's good. It's helpful. But for some of the bigger things, you described it as a system, a system for living your life or for viewing the world. It does fall apart for me in some quite profound ways.
It's important to talk about it, though, and shed more light on it, because many people look up to it. And, you know, if you check motivational videos on YouTube, for instance, they frequently talk about Stoicism and they talk about the Stoic mentality. I think that to one extent that's healthy, but as you say, to another extent, it's unhealthy.
Yeah.
What about talking a bit about Stoicism, then about Epictetus, then talk a bit about his work, and then proceed to ask questions such as whether Stoicism leads to fatalism, whether it is an attitude, a doctrine, both, and if so, what's the healthy dosage of Stoicism?
That's a really good way of putting it. What degree is good? Because I think if you get dogmatic about it, it can lead to fatalism. I think you've hit the nail on the head right away there, the word fatalism, that it can lead to that, a defeatism.
I think so.
Or an unhealthy degree of pacifism.
That's my opinion as
all
well.
All these things, right.
I mean, I may be wrong, but I think that you have something there, it's right. So the thing is that the main Stoic writings that we have are four. We have two by Epictetus, one by Seneca, and one by Marcus Aurelius. By Epictetus, we have the Enchiridion. It's something like a manual or handbook of Stoicism. The Discourses. By Seneca, we have various letters. And I think it's compiled together and called Letters from a Stoic. At least that's the way that interpreters and those who put together the book call it. And by Marcus Aurelius, we have the famous Meditations. Now, all of these Stoics have differences, but they also have significant commonalities. Now, let's talk a bit about Stoicism and then about Epictetus. So I think that the main Stoic insight is that we should not be control freaks.
Yeah.
That we don't control everything. And in fact, we control very few things. And that a sort of wisdom, the Stoic wisdom, is the wisdom to know the difference between what is up to us and what is not. What is, in a way, under our control and what is not. And Stoics think that if you want to live a happy life, you need to be wise and you need to practice accordingly. They think that if you have the correct views about something and if you have the correct understanding of value, you will most probably act accordingly. So in that respect, they were, like Socrates, they were intellectualists. They thought that every person is motivated to act in the way that they think is the best way to act. They don't believe in what is called frequently weakness of will, that sometimes we can think that something is the best course of action and do otherwise. This is a very long discussion in ancient ethics, and especially it becomes very prevalent with discussions of free will later on. But Stoics are not, generally speaking, in favor of free will in the strong sense, in the sense that other things being equal, we could have done otherwise. They are usually speaking determinists, and I think to an extent they're fatalists. Okay, so that's the main insight, that we should not be control freaks. And the thing is, where it becomes a bit weird is that they give a proposal of how to understand of where the line between what we control and what we don't lies, ultimately. Right. And they say that ultimately, what is up to us is our assent to things. So it's don't control how we react. We don't control what happens to us. We only control how we react in a psychological sense. So they focus on what is called internal freedom, or the achievement of an internal mental state, which they think constitutes the good life, and they call it ataraxia. It's the state where the soul is not disturbed by the passions. They thought that, for instance, the good life is the life of the person who whose soul is not disturbed by the passions. So the whole enterprise of Stoicism is geared around, or is focused on, achieving a sort of self-mastery in that sense, in the sense of silencing the passions. And you could say, in a way, living in the world but not being of the world, I think some sages have been characterized, especially in early Christianity.
I mean, right there, I don't necessarily entirely agree with that.
Yeah.
So be a robot then. Don't have emotions. I mean, no thanks. Yeah, no, I'll just opt out of that, if that's all right. I mean, again, on a small scale, that's totally not a bad idea. You know, to get in a rage about the fact you're stuck in traffic, for example, is a classic example.
Yes.
You're stuck in traffic and it's just not in your control anymore. You've got to sit there.
Yes.
And be bored. It's completely out of your control now. So, yeah, be stoic about it.
Don't go on a rampage.
Yeah. In a sense, just master your emotions, your passions, your rage, whatever it is. Okay. But to apply it to everything in life, you know, like the death of your own child. Don't be too emotional about it. I'm getting ahead of myself.
No, but I think that's a major point, and it illustrates a lot about how they viewed ethics in this. But I agree with you that I think what is really healthy in Stoicism is a focus on the idea that we don't control everything.
That is the key, isn't it? It's about control.
Yes.
What you can and can't control, what is or isn't in your power.
Yes.
Right.
And I think that to an extent, this can make us a bit more humane, in the sense that when we meditate upon the human condition and we understand our limitations, we stop expecting everything from other people. So, for instance, it seems to me that the paradigm of a non-Stoic approach is that taken by some spoiled children who ask everything of their parents. And if their parents cannot deliver what they ask of them, they just say, oh, you're bad. Fly to the moon. If you don't, you're bad. You're a bad person if you don't buy me a palace or get me a palace. That that is a non-Stoic mentality. It's a mentality that you could say that it is a bit inhumane, especially, I mean, okay, it's to be expected from children, of some children at least. Mm. And but if we heard that from an adult, we would say that person is not a good person, maybe.
Like a child who insists her father buys her a golden goose.
Yes.
And goes mad when he can't or won't.
Yes. And I think that part of being humane with respect to our relations has to do with sort of putting yourselves, how do you call it, on another person's shoes. Mm. Try to see how things are seen from the perspective of another person, but also try to meditate on some features of human life, not necessarily seen through the perspective of another. But for instance, we have limitations. We can't fly, for instance. Mm. We live right. We have lives of a particular range. Mm.
Mm.
We can't expect someone to live 200 years, for instance.
That's why here I'm going to criticize along the way various elements of Stoicism. But just to make it clear, I think loads of it is extremely good. Yes. Lots and lots of it is very, very helpful. For example, come to terms with the fact that you're not 7'1" and going to be a professional basketball player.
Yeah.
Come to terms with the fact, perhaps, that you simply haven't got the cognitive ability to be an astronaut or something.
Yeah.
You know, come to terms with the fact that you're going to die.
Yeah.
That the people you love that are older than you, you're going to see them die. Things like that. That is very, very helpful.
Yes.
You know, how do you deal with misery and disappointment? How do you cope? I know the word cope gets used in all different ways these days, mainly as sort of a trolling term. But you have to cope in life with loads of disappointments, profound exactly. disappointments. And it's not easy. It's really not easy. Life is tough. And you have to come to terms with some bad things.
Yes.
So, and Stoicism definitely helps with yes. that in some really big ways. So
it's the sure, idea that sure. you should not break, cultivate that sort of self-mastery that allows you to get by in a way and right. also yeah. flourish.
Keeping calm, that's a big part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, keeping calm and carrying
right.
on.
Right, yeah. Yeah, because it's easier said than done.
Yes.
Right, especially when there's something, you've lost something you can't replace. And sometimes in life that you even hit a state of panic.
Yes.
Sometimes, or despair, depression. Stoicism can help.
It can help, but here is where I think that it can also be a bit inhumane, in that they would say that they would try to teach people not to feel sorrow. So if the ideal is lack of disturbance of the soul, and sorrow disturbs the soul because it is a passion that is corrosive of our, let's say, Zen-like being, yeah. mode of being,
yeah.
it seems that they sort of say that in some cases, if bad things happen to people or to yourself or to people, that you shouldn't feel sorrow, that it is not worth it if you really be in tune with the universe.
Mm.
I don't think that's unfair. Some you know, friends of Stoicism may think that I'm completely unfair of this. Please tell us in the comments. But I think that this is somewhere where Stoicism is a bit... it becomes a bit inhumane.
Yeah, I think things like sorrow, sort of profound sorrow, it's almost certainly, in my opinion, it is healthier to go through that phase then.
Yes.
Don't pretend you're not sad.
Yes.
Don't pretend you're such at one with the universe that you're not sad that someone you loved died in a horrible way right in front of you or something.
Yes.
You're just going to pretend that it's neither here nor there. I mean, yeah. come on, let's be real. You're not a robot.
So we're going to proceed now to focus on the Enchiridion by Epictetus. Hmm. And let us talk a bit about short biographical okay. facts.
Yeah.
So Epictetus was the son of a woman slave born between 50 and 60 AD at Hierapolis in Phrygia.
Can I just say one thing quick right there, just to make it clear?
Yeah.
AD.
Yeah.
So he's not in the same, he's not one of the classical sort of Athenian philosophers. This is in the Roman period. This is in the early Imperial Roman period.
Yes, it is.
So it's not the 5th century BC. Yeah. Go on. Just wanted to make that clear to everyone.
By all means, just interject.
I think that's important.
Yes, so Stoicism is supposed to have started around 300 BC in Athens by Zeno of Citium. I think it was a Greek city-state in the south southeastern Mediterranean. And he went to travel to Athens and they spoke on the Stoa. That's where they come, Stoicism. Mm. And but we don't have full texts from the classic, the early Stoics like Zeno or Chrysippus. And the texts we have, as we said, come from Epictetus, Seneca, and Marcus Aurelius. And we have some testimonies of what they believed from some doxographers later on. But let's talk about Epictetus. Yeah. So somehow he went to Rome. It's not known exactly how. And while still in service, Epictetus took courses with Musonius Rufus, the fashionable Stoic philosopher who was fascinated by the sincere and dynamic personality and of Epictetus and trained him as a philosopher. Now, Epictetus was a slave. And this is where it becomes a bit interesting because Stoicism is a philosophy that appealed to people of all social classes. And it's fun because two of the most famous Stoics are completely different in their social status. Epictetus was a slave. Marcus Aurelius was the emperor of Rome. And one of the strong emperors. It's Rome was really, wasn't Rome at in a really powerful state at that point?
Yeah. I mean, he was one of, if not arguably, the most powerful man in the world.
Yeah.
I find that interesting. I mean, even Seneca as well was extremely wealthy. Yes. And extremely powerful, among the most powerful men in the world. He had the ear, at least for a while, of Nero, of the emperor.
So, well, was he an advisor to Nero? And I think you did
to
an
begin
e-books
with,
where
for
he,
a little bit of time, yeah.
He killed. He said that Nero, Seneca should be killed.
Sorry, what, Nero?
Yeah.
Yeah, Nero in the end
yeah.
insisted Seneca kill himself, yeah. But Seneca was extremely rich. Yes. He's like had a fabulous wealth.
Yeah.
And to varying degrees, was very, very powerful. But Marcus Aurelius, yeah, as emperor of Rome during one of its zeniths.
But the interesting thing here is that it shows that what people believe is not necessarily an outcome of the social class they feature in. Right. You can have people having ideas regardless of their social status. It doesn't mean that necessarily your views are determined by your social class and that class's interests. Okay, so he became a free man at some point and began teaching philosophy on street corners. And during the rule of Domitian, he and many other philosophers were exiled from Rome, and he went to Nicopolis in Epirus, in the northwestern part of Greece. And he established there his own school, and he was teaching, in a way, the Stoic way of life and the way he saw it. And he never wrote things like Socrates. He never wrote. What we have by Epictetus is actually written by and compiled together by Flavius Arrian, who's the famous historian. He wrote also the Conquests of Alexander. Mm. And Flavius Arrian was very much impressed by Epictetus, and he wrote down many notes from what Epictetus was saying, and these notes were compiled to the Enchiridion, the handbook of Stoicism, and the discourses. So Epictetus didn't write. He was purely concerned with teaching and his students, and Flavius Arrian was writing notes from him. So what we have today from Epictetus is actually compiled by Flavius Arrian, who listened to him.
So just to say, I'm a big fan of Arrian. He's my favorite account of the campaigns of Alexander. I've read that half a dozen times easily. So I'm a big fan of Arrian, I must say. But nice. I just wanted to add that.
Okay. So, and one thing to say, generally speaking about Stoicism was very interesting and very influential. And as an attitude, many people think that it was really impressive. And especially in the medieval period and in the early Renaissance, there was a really strong emphasis on Stoicism. So from antiquity, we had the schools, at least when it came to Hellenistic ethics, the ethics that come after Aristotle, the main two figures are Epicurus and Epicureanism and the Stoics. And the Christian church misrepresented Epicurus. They misrepresented him as a hedonist in the sense of someone who went around pleasures. He wasn't exactly that. He did think that pleasure was an important part of life, but he was not advocating debauchery.
Right, yeah, still in moderation.
Yes. Right, but yeah. Stoicism was supposed to be a bit more healthy and a bit more important.
Well, isn't it the case that sort of four of the main virtues that Stoics say you should sort of cultivate in yourself, courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance?
Yes.
It's sort of self-denial, self-control, self-discipline, and moderation, like abstinence, you know, in quite a strong sense, you know, don't indulge really at all.
These are the four cardinal virtues that many thinkers thought that they were the integral part of eudaimonistic ethics, the ethics where eudaimonia or flourishing is the ultimate goal.
Whereas didn't Epicurus say, you know, drink wine, but, you know, it's still in moderation, but if you want to drink some wine, drink some wine. If that's going to make you happy, that's fine. If you want to have some sex, go ahead, as long as it's in moderation.
Yes.
But, you know, so you can see, at least in a sort of a low resolution view, you can say, well, he's a hedonist.
Yes.
And he's sort of a temperate. It's very temperate.
I think the motive behind presenting Epicurus as an advocate of debauchery was his philosophical materialism. Right. It was seen to be a sort of threat to the doctrines of the church.
Right. Yeah.
And to be fair, I mean, materialism is not necessarily consistent. It doesn't seem to me to be consistent with belief in divine. In the divine, at least in the way that Christianity understands it. And that was, I think, the main motive.
Right.
And, and maybe materialists of future epochs were referring to Epicurus, and maybe they wanted to find him guilty by association, because very frequently when it comes to the battle of ideas, when one side doesn't want to engage in extended argumentation with the other side, they frequently want to present the other side as being completely wrong. And one of the ways of doing that is to say, okay, what are the philosophical underpinnings? What are the philosophical foundations of the beliefs propagated by the other side? Let's reject them and let's present them as wholesale or entirely wrong. Reject them wholesale. So that was the, let's close that tangent by about Epicurus. And one thing to say, Stoicism was particularly valued by the thinkers of Scottish Enlightenment, such as Adam Smith and David Hume.
Right,
they wrote highly of Stoicism. I don't think they were Stoics, but they wrote very highly of Stoicism. And Adam Smith, who we will touch definitely on the future videos, he said that self-control and a sort of Stoic attitude is a sort of virtue. And people tend to lose it in societies that develop much. And that's to their detriment.
For a future, if I could be penciled in for the David Hume episode, I'd be interested in that. Can I do Hume? Because as I say, I've got some fairly profound criticisms of Stoicism and some specific ones we'll get into. But still, there's big chunks of it, big whole parts of the very foundations of Stoicism are good.
Yes.
I really do think so. Like the idea of having courage in life, in all sorts of ways, to be brave, to have endurance and strength and fortitude, to approach things with sort of integrity and clarity. There's nothing wrong with any of that.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. You know,
it's
it really
all about
is brilliant.
The middle ground. Where lies moderation?
Right. Well, I think we'll get to that, I suppose. But that is the key. Where do you draw the line on these things? For example, one of the other key tenets is justice. Again, brilliant. To be fair and honest.
Yes.
And fair-minded. To be essentially good or kind, whatever that really means to you. That's great, isn't it? If everyone lived their life like that, there would be far, far fewer problems in the world if everyone lived like that. But
I'm not exactly certain about this for one reason, because it seems to me that when we say, okay, be good, be just.
Right.
And people, the thing is, how do we understand goodness and understand justice?
Of course.
And there are many people who understand it differently.
Right, yeah.
And sometimes maybe we need the opposite. We need a sort of framework where we can coexist with people who have different views of what the good life consists in. I think that's a feature of the modern world that personally I think is good to an extent. I think obviously if society tends to disintegrate, desperate times need desperate measures. But I think that generally speaking, that's a good way of going about it.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right though. I mean, what are the definitions of these things? If your idea of justice is that an apostate gets executed without question, well, to the West, that's a sort of a twisted sense of justice, isn't it? That's not just. That's not fair. But yeah, also the idea of wisdom, you know, that to use logic and study and all these types of things, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's a brilliant way to live your life, really.
One of the things that I want to get across with the symposium series is that we really need a sort of Aristotelian notion of wisdom that is a bit more anarchic than the top-down notions of wisdom that many systematists are trying to put forward. Aristotle does allow for the idea that we have limits to what we can systematize, and that there may be cases for a situated judgment where we require wisdom. And it seems to me that this is particularly potent with respect to in finding where something should be, is healthy and where is not. So for instance, instead of saying Stoicism, reject it wholesale, or Epicureanism, embrace it wholesale, let us focus on what it is supposed to be about and see when it is the pros and cons of each position. This seems to me to be much more sophisticated, and it seems to me to lead to a sort of intellectual growth that I think is a key part of flourishing, at least the way I see it. So should we go to the text by Epictetus and discuss some quotes?
Sure.
So let's talk about the first quote. I think that is really good and pithy. So we read, "Of things, some are in our power and others are not. In our power are opinion, movement towards a thing, desire, aversion, turning from a thing, and in a word, whatever are our acts. Not in our power are the body, property," he means possessions, "reputation, offices," like magisterial powers, "and in a word, whatever are not our acts. And the things in our power are by nature free, not subject to restraint or hindrance. But the things not in our power are weak, slavish, subject to restraint in the power of others. Remember then that if you think the things which are by nature slavish, to be free, and the things which are in the power of others to be your own, you will be hindered. You will lament, you will be disturbed. You will blame both gods and men. But if you think that only which is your own to be your own, and if you think that what is another's, as it really is, belongs to another, no man will ever compel you. No man will ever hinder you. You will never blame any man. You will accuse no man. You will do nothing involuntarily. No man will harm you. You will have no enemy, for you will not suffer any harm." So I think that's a brilliant quote. But again, we see that it's a mixed bag.
Yeah. I mean, so you can tell that his end, the sort of the end aim of it is to never be hurt.
Yes.
Well, on the most fundamental level, I feel like it's impossible to avoid that. They're really desperately trying, Stoics are desperately trying to avoid any disturbance in their psyche or something.
Yes.
It's like that's not going to be possible. I mean, that's also part of it as well. That's the sort of the contradiction, is that they also accept that massively. It's a massive part of Stoicism, isn't it? Especially Marcus Aurelius. It's realize that misery is inevitable.
Yes.
And accept it. So I just think it is really interesting, this idea that don't shy away from the sort of the reality that you're going to be disappointed and sorrowful, but in some way that's going to help you. I mean, it is also true. I'm not denying it's not true.
I have trouble with respect to thinking that this is moral. In what sense? I'm not saying that it has nothing good about it, but it seems to me that, for instance, I wouldn't want not to feel sorrow when some of my people have misfortune, face misfortunes.
Yeah.
So, and I was thinking, for instance, it just came to my mind. There's a novel by Albert Camus called The Stranger. And I think at some point, is it in the beginning where, tell us in the comments if we got it wrong. Is there in the beginning or at some point where his mother dies and he feels nothing?
Yeah, I read that a long time ago and I can't remember it very well. And then he goes on something like that.
And shoots someone at just because he was bored or something.
Yeah.
Gosh. So that's how weird.
It's one of those things, you know, when you've seen a film, you've definitely sat through that and then you can't really remember anything in it. Yes. Unfortunately, that's the case for me with The Stranger.
But if that's the case, it seems to me that that's not a moral person. It's
right. Yeah.
So I mean, there is more pain. We have two scenarios, let's forget the novel. Maybe I got it wrong. But if we have two scenarios, we have one person who does not lament about the death of, let's say, his mother, and another person who does lament about the death of his mother. It seems to me that may be weird, but it seems to me that the second person is a better person. So in a way, in some case, the second person, the person who laments, is more disturbed. But I don't think that it's a virtue not being disturbed.
Right, yeah.
So it seems to me that Stoics may be fetishizing lack of emotion.
Yeah. So again, it's like, to what degree, where do you draw the line? That's sort of my fundamental problem with Stoicism, is that when people try to apply it across the board, or where they draw the line, where they sort of, you'd have to sort of pretend you're not feeling the emotions anymore. Okay, so like, again, this idea of being stuck in traffic.
Yes.
It is sort of possible and definitely desirable to just allow the frustration to just slip away from you. It's totally possible and it's for the best. But to do the same with the death of your own child or death of your parent or anyone you love, your wife or husband or anything, it's not good. It's not normal. It's not moral.
Yes.
It's not healthy. I wouldn't have thought, but they do that. But that is specifically what the Stoics say. You know, they say things like, always remember, whenever you kiss your wife or something, remember she's immortal and she might die, so that when it happens, you won't be too upset. I think that is odd to me. I don't think that's great. Don't love your children too much. Don't get too attached to your own children because they might die. I mean, I just don't think that's correct. I just don't.
I don't think either. And it seems to me that there are various things here. There are various levels. On the one hand, I think it is good to meditate on human mortality. I don't think there is anything wrong with being constantly reminded of it, with constantly thinking of it. It could give us a sort of compass, let's say, a healthy reminder that we are not going to live forever, our people are not going to live forever, and we should basically not postpone being good to them, them being good to us. And also we should not live lives that we could say are a bit inauthentic, where we constantly bracket things and our values and, or let's say, aspirations, because we think that we're going to live forever. And then at some point we wake up and we're too old and we cannot do any of that. So it seems to me that that's healthy. And it is consistent with caring about your wife, caring about your children, and wanting to prolong their life. So I don't know what the Stoics would say about the latter part, but definitely I think that it is fair to say that to an extent they do have something important to say here. And especially meditating on our mortality.
To an extent, yes. Absolutely.
So it's not up to us whether we will live forever or not. We won't.
Right.
Yeah. But we could say that it is up to us as to whether we live a little longer or live a bit better. So it seems to me that we could extract the good things from Stoicism as an attitude.
Absolutely.
And keep them and maintain them and integrate them into another, let's say, ethic that is a bit more understanding of human beings and incorporates emotion in it a bit better.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.